From WYPR in Baltimore, this is Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Tom Hall. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has been making headlines here in Baltimore after agents arrested and detained two area immigrants without criminal records back in February. The men were just released last Thursday after advocacy lawyers argued their cases in front of immigration judges. On another recent occasion, ICE agents hand-delivered a letter to a local restaurant, the Boathouse, requesting paperwork on the restaurant's employees, and 30 workers immediately quit out of fear. This hour on Midday, we ask, what are the repercussions of the Trump administration's immigration policy? Is there reason for the climate of fear that it's causing? How much of Trump's stance is simply inflammatory rhetoric? And just how different is his policy from his predecessors? Join us on Midday, right after the news. Good afternoon. This is Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, sitting in for Tom Hall. On our program today, a conversation about the intersection of policy, rhetoric, and fear as we ask the question, what is it like to be an immigrant in Baltimore in the Trump era? When he was candidate, Donald Trump called for the immediate deportation of millions of undocumented immigrants, aka illegal aliens. And as president, Mr. Trump and his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, have made immigration enforcement a priority. Plans continue, of course, for a wall of unprecedented scale all along the U.S.-Mexico border. And the Department of Justice has made clear that sanctuary cities, which do not check the immigration status of people who are stopped by police for other reasons or who are seeking public services, those cities will risk losing federal funds. Baltimore, by the way, is not officially a sanctuary city. It is, however, a welcoming city, according to Mayor Catherine Pugh. Indeed, this is a city with a long history of welcoming immigrants. So what is it like to be a foreign-born worker, an illegal alien in Baltimore today? Has the Trump administration's anti-immigrant rhetoric led to harsher treatment of foreign-born workers? In this hour, we're going to get to hear the stories of two local workers who, in fact, fear deportation. And we're going to ask experts on both sides of the issue to weigh in about whether and how much immigration enforcement has changed under the current administration. Later this hour, attorney Jill Bussey is going to be joining the conversation here in Studio A. Jill Bussey is the advocacy director for the Catholic Legal Immigration Network Incorporated, known as CLINIC. CLINIC is a nationwide network of nonprofit organizations that offer immigration legal services. Also joining us is going to be Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. He's going to join us by phone. He is a senior legal fellow there at the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. Right now, though, I want to introduce you to two Baltimore residents who are working right here in various circumstances. Neither one is a citizen. Neither one is working legally. Both are paying taxes. And one of them, we'll call her Lisa, has 9 employees working for her. Lisa runs her own cleaning business. She came to the U.S. from Honduras 15 years ago. 3 of her 4 children were born here, and she is afraid right now of what might happen to them if she is deported. We're going to meet Lisa in a moment, but first we're going to hear the story of Pedro. Pedro came to the U.S. from Mexico about 18 years ago, when he was a teenager at the time. Pedro works at a Baltimore restaurant, and he is undocumented. Pedro, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Let me start, Pedro, by asking you to tell the story of how you came to the U.S. and why.
It was part of seeing people pursuing, you know, following the American dream and looking for a better way of living, so... at the time, I had some relatives living in New York City. I came, I was 17, started working in the restaurant business ever since. And back then, it was just working hard, saving money, no fear. Things were different back then.
Was coming to the U.S. legally any sort of practical option for you?
My... parents was five brothers, and I just wanted to give them, you know, a better way of living. I helped them build a better house. I came here for that reason. And
so when you came to New York.
That's
you
correct.
Met up with family there.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about how you made it from New York to Baltimore.
I have most of my relatives living in New York, and then one day at a concert, I saw one of my cousins that I thought he was living in Texas. So he said, no, I'm actually living in Baltimore. So we made arrangements. We met here. He took me fishing, hiking, and do lots of outdoor activities that you don't often do in New York. So when we went to his house, I said, how much did you pay for the house? He said, $700. So I realized I was paying too much in New York.
It's what brings a lot of people here from New York to Baltimore.
And it's definitely a lot more affordable city.
Let me ask a question with some nuance here, Pedro. And as I do, let me let listeners know that with me in studio is WIPR reporter, City Hall reporter, Dominique Maria Bonessi. She's going to be here helping with some translation when necessary. And here's what I want to get at. And Dominique, maybe you can help me out. Mm-hmm. I wonder, Pedro, if you might explain how when you came to the U.S., what do you say to people who ask, why didn't you try to come here legally? Was it realistic to go through the channels to come here to this country legally?
Would you like me to
Dominique, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, ¿cómo llegaste al país? ¿Cómo había una posibilidad de llegar aquí legalmente sin tener que llegar ilegalmente? ¿Cómo ir por el borde? ¿Cómo entraste al país principio? ¿Cómo entraste por un chequeo de guardianos en el borde o entraste por avión o cómo fue cómo llegaste al país?
No, de hecho yo llegué a la frontera y en la frontera teníamos una el coyote esperando para cruzarnos.
So there are coyotes on the border to help him cross over the border. There was no checkpoint to go over.
And when you say coyotes, for listeners, explain what that term means.
So coyotes are men who are paid human traffickers, essentially, that assist with getting people over the border. Oftentimes it comes with a fee. ¿Pagaste a este coyote a llevarte a
los tiempos eran $800.
It was $800 to pay for the coyote to bring him. $800 US or
US dollars.
US dollars. Y pero había un canal legal a entrar.
Tenía la opción, pero en realidad la gente que puede venir legalmente es porque tiene suficiente dinero. O pueden probar que hay cosas que los van a hacer regresar y no se van a quedar ilegalmente. Entonces, en realidad, la mejor opción es simplemente cruzarla, arriesgarse a cruzar la frontera.
So, essentially, yes, it is possible to come legally, of course, but for the people who are coming legally, a lot of them are making a lot more money than, you know, the average person. And, you know, coming illegally is obviously cheaper. And people who do come legally also are able to, you know, make a living, have some sort of already family established here, maybe have a business in Mexico that they're trying to bring to the United States. So there's all these factors that work into that.
Pedro, tell me what your life is like in Baltimore these days. Do you have family here?
Yes, I do.
Yeah,
I have Children? A 9-year-old. He goes to Baltimore City School. Mm-hmm. He's a great kid. He was also invited for Loyola Blakefield. This is his second year. Mom and I are not together, but split him literally three and a half days.
And how about your work situation? Tell me about do you have a Social Security card?
No,
are you off the books? How does that work?
About 15 years ago, when I was living in New York, I remember it was a friend from Ecuador. He was legal, but his brother-in-law was not. He started explaining about paying taxes, and I had no very clear idea what it was at the time. So I started, you know, finding out a little more information. He said you too could pay taxes. The government takes taxes from what you do for work, and then at the end of the year, depending on everybody's circumstances, people get money back.
So how is it that you are undocumented, illegal, don't have a Social Security card, but still are paying taxes?
So I went to the Social Security office at the time in New York, and they asked me for basically approve of me having an open case so they could give me an open case with immigration so they could give me a Social Security. Since I didn't have one, they said I could go to the IRS and request a taxpayer identification number. So at the time, I went myself to the office in Queens, and with my passport, I applied for a taxpayer identification number that I've been using ever since.
Does that give you the same benefits as a Social Security card in the sense of, you know, like a deduction for a dependent? You have a you say you have a 9-year-old child.
Right. It does, but at the end of a year, they still hold $1,000 credit from your child since you don't have a Social Security. And then your accountant usually recommends you that if you ever get a Social Security number, to go back, and then you can get that $1,000 credit for the kid that you don't get.
Okay.
So it's basically for tax purposes.
Lisa, I'm going to get to your story in just a moment, but Pedro, let me just ask you finally to tell me what the conversations are like between you and other folks in your situation, undocumented workers these days. Is there an increased fear about the changes in immigration policy under President Trump?
Oh, definitely. Just back then when Obama and you know, other presidents, you would hear about, you know, them getting rid of really bad people, people that had bad record. But so far, I know two friends that have been deported and that they had no criminal record, and they just were in the wrong time and they got asked for documents.
Do you think then much about what might happen if ICE agents found their way to your door?
Probably not my way to my door because I just moved, so I'm not so concerned about that, but definitely they can track where I work and stuff like that.
Yeah. What would happen to you if they found their way to you and if you faced deportation? I mean, like, what would happen to your son? What would happen? Do you think about these eventualities, these consequences?
I definitely have. It's funny because mom and I don't get along very well, but when it comes to our child, we often have communication. So we already make a couple phone calls and say, listen, if you get deported, you will be in charge of the child. If I get deported, you will be in charge of the child. And then we're actually thinking of making a letter so in case we both get deported, either someone else can be in charge for a minute so we see what we do with him and whether we bring it to Mexico or have it here with relatives in the meantime.
A contingency plan. And I see Lisa sitting next to you nodding her head as well. Lisa, let me turn to you now and ask you to tell us your story. You came here from Honduras. And tell me what brought you here.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you very much for inviting me to your program. And then it's really sad, you know, what's happening right now with our community. And I am here, you know, to tell my story and also, you know, to raise my voice, you know, for others that they can. 15 years ago, I came here to this country because I have a special needs daughter. You know, I left her, you know, by a year in my country. And when I came here, it was a different history. You know, when I came here for work to make a better life for her and for my parents as well, for my other relatives. And life, it was, you know, much better. Working hard, yes. I was, you know, usually I was working at different things over there. I was studying engineering computers over there, and when I came here, you know, it was totally different. I become to have a cleaning business, but you know, it was a work. It was what we have in that moment.
Tell me a little bit more about your situation as a business owner. It's an interesting situation that you hear on one hand, you are, an illegal immigrant, undocumented, but you're a business owner. How does that work?
Well, like Pedro says, you know, about the ITIN number that they gave it to us, you be able to work very hard and pay a lot of money to IRS, but you don't receive the benefits. And a lot of people, you know, don't know about that. You know, it's an honor business. I pay $20,000 a year, sometimes $30,000 a year. And I don't have the opportunity to, you know, to really have the money or some part of the money back like other, you know, American citizen.
I'm going to ask you the same question you heard me ask Pedro. Tell me what the conversations are like between you and other folks, undocumented workers in your situation these days.
Well, a lot of people, they were scared, you know, like really scared about their kids, you know, because if you, like he says, in the meantime, you got but immigration is a big problem because your kids being alone, you know, they are really afraid of it.
Tell me about, you heard Pedro talking about a contingency plan. Take me inside your mind, your psychology as a mother. How real is this threat to you on a daily basis? And have you talked to your children about it? I mean, what are the family conversations like?
Yeah, it's a big deal. My husband and I, you know, been having that conversation, you know, like over and over. And that's what we're going to do, you know, is write a letter, you know, for somebody else, you know, for a few days, they can take over our kids and then into they can send them back to our country.
Pero quieres hablar sobre lo que pasa con tu hija y en general en Honduras, si te la mandan a alguien a tu país, que es difícil que les van a matar o algo. ¿Quieres explicar más o en español o en inglés?
Claro. Es muy difícil para una madre que tiene niños. En mi caso, mi hija es especial. Ha venido mucho a aprender mucho a este lugar. Ella vino acá sin saber inglés.
So I asked her about returning to Honduras and the reason it's so difficult for her to return to Honduras. So she was saying that, you know, her daughter has come into this country, her special needs daughter has come into this country, and, you know, when she originally had her, we had this conversation before we got on air, the doctors in Honduras said she would only live for 3 months. But she came to this country, she's 17 now, correct?
Yeah.
And she, you know, has had help from Johns Hopkins University. She's been going to school in Towson and, you know, really been, you know, she's learned English. She says even better than her. and, you know, she's really taken steps for improving. But if she were to leave, ¿qué va a pasar si tú dejas tu hija aquí y vas por Honduras otra vez?
Like I said before, is the worst thing, you know, because they can't, you know, my daughter can't live by herself.
Lisa, business owner, mother, undocumented immigrant from Honduras, I want to thank you for sharing your story. Pedro, thank you as well. And Dominique Maria Bonesi, WYPR City Hall reporter, thank you for your translation services this segment. You are tuned to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin in for Tom Hall. We are talking about immigration this hour. And when we return after the break, we're going to hear from two experts about immigration policy changes, anti-immigrant rhetoric under the Trump administration. Join the conversation with your thoughts, your questions, your concerns. The phone number, 410-662-8780. Are you an immigrant yourself? Are you here legally or illegally? Documented, undocumented? If so, what are your thoughts? How are you feeling? How is your life changing on account of the new administration's immigration policy? Maybe you're someone who relies on immigrant workforce. How is Trump's policy and his rhetoric changing the way you operate? The number again, 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
You're tuned to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, sitting in for Tom Hall. The number to call this hour, 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. What are the actual goals of U.S. immigration policy? Are the ways in which we're enforcing that policy achieving its goals? Is the side effect of Trump's policies and rhetoric making the U.S. a less attractive place for immigrants in general? And if so, Is that a good thing for the country? Your thoughts, your questions, your concerns are welcome. 410-662-8780. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, it is the Midday Culture Connection with guest host Dr. Sherry Parks, Associate Dean at the University of Maryland College Park, and a conversation about how differences in culture often lead to the tension and mistrust between police and African Americans. Dr. Parks is going to be joined by Elise White, an assistant professor of public service at NYU, Rich Morin, senior editor at the Pew Research Center, and Edward Jackson, a former Baltimore police colonel who now teaches criminal justice at Baltimore City Community College. If you're just tuning in, we are talking about undocumented immigrants this hour, and attorney Jill Bussey is with me in studio. She is advocacy director for the Catholic Legal Immigration Network Incorporated, known as CLINIC. CLINIC is based in Silver Spring. It is a nationwide network of nonprofit organizations that offer immigration legal services. And Jill, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Standing by on the line from the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. is Hans von Spakovsky. He is senior legal fellow at Heritage's Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. Mr. von Spakovsky is also co-author of the 2014 book Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. It is a critical assessment of former Obama administration attorney General Eric Holder. Hans von Spakovsky, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. von Spakovsky, stand by for a few moments while I give Attorney Jill Bussey an opportunity to tell us a little bit about CLINIC. First of all, Jill, tell us what you do and the services you provide.
Yes, thank you. Mainly, we're focused on supporting the over 300 nonprofit organizations in our network that provide direct immigration legal services, mainly to low-income immigrants. At this moment in time, CLINIC is focused on the rights and dignity of immigrants and their families. In the United States, we believe that all humans should live with dignity, and we're deeply concerned and troubled by what we're seeing, much of what Lisa shared about having to prepare families who are being impacted by the current policies. We put a lot of our efforts into building resources for those legal services providers. One of the things that we're focused on right now is a 50-state resource for families like Lisa's who are preparing their families for potential separation, including resources on guardianship and powers of attorney. Those very practical but very necessary matters that need to be taken into.
Jill Bussey, talk to me about how much more difficult your work has become under the Trump administration. How does Trump's rhetoric compare to the actual policy changes and implementations? And how different are Trump's policies from his predecessor, President Obama?
Yeah, thank you, Aaron. I've been with CLINIC for a little bit over 2 years, but I've been an immigration attorney and in the immigration field for over 20 years. So I have some perspective from previous administrations, not just the Obama administration. Largely in the past, under Clinton, Bush, and for most of the Obama administration, we didn't see significant change. And I'm speaking in generalities, significant change in enforcement. That changed a little bit in 2014 when the Obama administration articulated clear priorities in which they wanted to engage in enforcement of the immigration laws here in the United States. Those 2014 priorities set forth three tiers, if you will, of individuals that the ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, and other immigration officials would focus their efforts on. And the very first priority, of course, were something I think we all have common ground here. We don't want serious criminal aliens living in the United States. So that was one of the top tier. At the lower end of the tier were recent entrants to the United States. And Obama, similar to Trump, actually had articulated in his messaging a focus on felons, not families. And we've heard that articulated as well in a different form by the President Trump in his focusing on bad hombres. And we assume that by bad hombres, he means criminal aliens, serious criminals here in the United States. So the big difference that I think we have seen is in implementation and whether the implementation is consistent with messaging. Under the Obama administration, we saw, again, the messaging was felons, not families. In that very first year of implementation of that policy, over 80% of the individuals who were actually removed from the United States were criminal felons who should have been removed from the United States. In the second year of that policy, we saw more of a focus on recent entrants. So I believe it was about 70 or 80% of the individuals who were removed in that last year of the Obama administration fell into that bucket, if you will. But again, the messaging and the priorities, we saw consistency in implementation, which is a difference in what we're seeing under the Trump policy and administration.
That's Attorney Jill Bussey, speaking advocacy director for the Catholic Legal Immigration Network Incorporated, a nationwide network of nonprofit organizations that offer immigration legal services. Standing by with us is Hans von Spakovsky, senior legal fellow at the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Mr. von Spakovsky, welcome to the program, and let me give you a chance to respond to what you've heard from Jill Bussey so far and to maybe talk to the effect of this demonstrated change at this point and who exactly is being targeted within the undocumented immigrant population.
Sure, but let me make one point first, and that is that, you know, we keep talking about immigration, and I think it is very important to differentiate between legal immigration and illegal immigration. There's this push out there in the media and elsewhere making what I consider to be a very false claim, that if you are against illegal immigration, then you must be racist and against immigration. And I just don't hold with that. You know, we are the most welcoming country in the world. We take in more than 1 million legal immigrants a year. That's more than all the other countries in the world. And the fact that the Trump administration came in saying, and with the support of the American people, that they wanted our immigration laws actually enforced does not mean that we are anti-immigrant. In fact, I would cite to you a great quote from Barbara Jordan, civil rights icon. You may recall she was put in charge of a commission on immigration reform by Bill Clinton in the 1990s. And she said, you know, that she disagreed with anyone who would label efforts to control immigration as being inherently anti-immigrant, that it's a right and a responsibility for a democratic society to manage immigration so it serves the national interest. And this is the most important part. She said that if the country didn't do a better job in curbing illegal immigration, it would risk irreparably undermining our commitment to legal immigration. And I think that's a very important point to keep in mind. On changes in enforcement, if you look at the executive orders that the president signed, you will see that, yeah, they have changed things. For example, he ordered the Department of Homeland Security to stop and end the catch-and-release policy. The Border Patrol agents cynically referred to it as the catch-and-run policy. And what that meant was that if an illegal alien was caught or detained in the interior of the country, what would happen is they would give him or her a date to appear before a immigration judge and then release them. The statistics on this, and I did a study on this, showed that 40% of illegal aliens who were detained, given a court date, and then released, never showed up for court. And so that catch-and-release policy was basically a way of allowing people to remain in the country illegally. The other important thing to keep in mind is that while the Obama administration said, well, its priority was criminal aliens, there was actually a House report issued, House Judiciary report issued about a year and a half ago that showed that they weren't doing a very good a job of that. In 2013 fiscal year, the Obama administration released over 36,000 criminal aliens and then released another 31,000 in 2014. So these were criminal aliens, and yet they were released and not deported, which showed that they were basically releasing people who are very dangerous back into our society.
Hans von Spakovsky, thank you for your perspective. I'm going to turn back to you, Attorney Jill Bussey, and have you talk a little bit about your on-the-ground experience working with immigrants in our local area with with the arrival of ICE agents, mm-hmm. There have been a couple of local headlines here in Baltimore. Just last week, there were two Highlandtown area men who were released from, they had been detained since February. These were men without criminal records. They got advocate lawyers that were able to get them released in front of immigration judges. And then also we have this interesting case here in Baltimore with a letter, hand-delivered letter from ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to a local area restaurant, the Boathouse, asking for papers on the workers. The management, as sort of a professional courtesy, let everybody who was employed there know that they'd received this letter. And then 30 folks didn't show up for work the next day, and the business was effectively crippled. It's day-to-day operations. Talk about ICE enforcement is under the Trump administration. Is there a longer leash here? Is there a sense of ICE enforcers being emboldened? How does this square with the priorities of who is being targeted for deportation?
Well, thank you. Yes, and I would like to clarify that unlike the Obama administration, where there were these three tiers of priorities set forth by the Obama administration, the Trump administration has starkly changed its enforcement policy by essentially saying everyone who is a non-citizen, and let me be careful and cautious with those words, anyone who is a non-U.S. citizen, not just undocumented individuals living here, are at risk for deportation. So essentially everyone's a priority. And when everyone is a priority, by the way, not messaging, matching the messaging of just the bad hombres, right? So when everyone's a priority, what is the impact on our society? What is the impact on our local communities like Baltimore that has a tremendously rich immigrant history and is known to be welcoming, as you mentioned, to immigrants? In fact, my great-grandfather came from Germany through the port of Baltimore here many years ago, and it was the second largest port of entry in the United States at that time. This is a beautiful community filled with diverse ethnicities that largely has, you know, lived together and thrived together economically, are developing this this beautiful, rich city. So what's the impact when you have everyone's a priority as the priority? You see, like in Highlandtown, after these gentlemen were taken into custody, that children weren't attending school. That in parishes and in churches, people weren't showing up for worship. That's a tremendous impact on our society. We also have at Johns Hopkins, there was a letter from the president of Johns Hopkins soon after the election that expressed concern about the policies, the Muslim ban, if you will, that individuals would not be able to come from abroad to seek life-saving medical treatment. And that happens in our communities as well, where you have individuals who are not coming to do their well check-in, their well child visit, because they're afraid of going to medical centers.
Attorney Jill Bussey and Hans von Spakovsky, stand by just a moment. We're going to go to the phones now to hear from our listeners. The phone number, by the way, to call in and join this conversation, 410-662-8780. And we're going to hear now from Jonathan in Baltimore. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. I want to say hello to Tom and, you know, Jill and Hans. Thank you for all your work that you guys do. I wanted to add that a lot of the times it's hard for immigrants to, you know, to apply legally. So a lot of times you have to enter the country illegally to get the opportunity to even apply legally. And then once you do, it often takes a lot of money. I'm talking tens of thousands to, you know, file for the actual process, which is hard to get that kind of money when you can't work legally. So it's a kind of a rock in the hard place, you know. Of course, we all would love to go through the legal route to do so, but to even get the chance to do so, we have to, you know, immigrate illegally, and then you get yourself into a... The problem gets harder and harder trying to solve the problem.
Jonathan in Baltimore reiterating the thoughts of Pedro, who we heard during the first segment of our program, would love to be able to come to the country legally. It's just not financially feasible. Jill and Hans, I'm going to let you guys ponder that last caller for a minute as we get ready to take a quick break. I do want to say on Mondays here on Midday, it is our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence here in our city in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 187 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, 4 people were the victims of homicide in the city. They are Antoine Fritz, age 23, Devontae Woodley, age 23, and 2 unidentified men. In addition, the medical examiner ruled last week that the death of Lyndon Waddell Jr. was a homicide. Mr. Waddell was shot on January 5th of this year and died on April 8th. He was 29. It's Midday. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about immigration policy here this hour on Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Tom Hall. Earlier in the show, we heard from 2 foreign-born workers, one of whom owns a business here in Baltimore, and they shared with us their personal fears about deportation. We took those stories as a starting point for our policy discussion this hour, a conversation that continues now with our guests, attorney Jill Bussey, who is here in studio. She is advocacy director for the Catholic Legal Immigration Network Incorporated, known as CLINIC. CLINIC is based in Silver Spring. It is a nationwide network of nonprofit organizations that offer immigration legal services. And joining me on the line from Washington, D.C. is Hans von Spakovsky. He is senior legal fellow at the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. If you have questions, comments this hour, you are welcome to call us. The phone number 410-662-8780. What do you think, listeners? How realistic are Trump's goals of deporting all illegal immigrants and reducing the influx to zero? Do you like that idea? How expensive would that be? And would it be worth it? 410-662-8780. And let's start this segment by going back to the phones again and hearing from a few listeners. We'll turn now to Carol in Anne Arundel County. Carol, you're on the air.
Yes. The lady that said her grandfather came here from Germany as an immigrant. So did my grandparents. I'm willing to bet they came here as legal immigrants. That's the word you continually leave out. Also, 25% of all the Union troops that served in the Civil War were German immigrants. So perhaps they might think about a policy to come here where they can serve in the military. I do sympathize with your situation, but this is bizarre, the way we have things now. It needs to change, but we have to be a country of laws. If we don't respect our laws, we have nothing.
Carol,
we need to change them.
We hear you loud and clear. We appreciate your thoughts. Carol saying, you know, the law is the law. But maybe we ought to think about a smarter policy that doesn't require so many people sort of being cornered into a situation where they have to circumvent the law or break the law.
Yes. Hi, Carol. And to Jonathan's point, I think Jonathan had a very good question about what does it take now under the current policy to come here through the proper channels. I mentioned my great-grandfather who, when he came from Germany to Baltimore, there were no laws. All you had to do is pass the very easy, to most extent, medical test. They looked in your eyeballs and made sure you didn't have an infectious eye disease and that you weren't coughing up blood, and you were allowed in from Europe for the most part. You know, I was just at Ellis Island recently, and that was a tremendous focus there, that back in the day when most of our grandparents or great-great-grandparents were coming into the United States, there was not control of the border. So saying that my great-great-grandparents did it right, yeah, they came off the boat. That was the only line that they needed to get through, was the line off the boat. So now our laws are a lot more complex. And to Jonathan's point, it's difficult for immigrants who are trying to do it right to navigate this extremely complex immigration system, a system that President Trump himself has recognized just very recently, saying that we need comprehensive immigration reform.
Hans von Spakovsky, I'm going to let you chime in here. You just heard Jill Bussey responding to our caller. You know, immigration, doing it the right way, doing it the legal way, is expensive. It takes time. And a lot of the folks coming to our country illegally are the ones who are taking the jobs that pay next to nothing. How do you square this? Does this work under the auspices of Trump's current policy? And if not, is there a smarter answer to the current immigration policy?
Well, Americans aren't going to agree to reforming our immigration laws until they finally see Washington having the willpower to actually enforce our laws against illegal immigration. That's pretty clear in all the polling, and I certainly agree with that. But I also agree with the prior caller. And again, I would go back to, this idea that it's difficult to go through the legal immigration policy. We take in more legal immigrants than any other country in the world. Okay, that is something to keep in mind throughout all of this. And what I heard in these other stories was people who didn't want to have to bother with the legal immigration policy because they could pay $800 to somebody to smuggle them in illegally. And most of those smugglers, by the way, work for the big dangerous drug cartels. And this idea that...
With respect to, sir, I think it wasn't that they didn't want to bother. I think it was they simply didn't have the money to do it legally.
It doesn't take a lot of money to file an application to immigrate to the United States. If you run into difficulties because you don't have the eligibility for it, well then, yeah, you might have to get a lawyer to represent you. But my parents were immigrants to this country in the 1950s. I know very well what the immigration process is. Yeah, there are improvements that can be made, but that's not an excuse for people coming to the country illegally. And I would tell you that this huge influx of illegal aliens actually hurts the employment prospects of many Americans. Again, I would cite to you Barbara Jordan, once again, who talked about the fact that the economic impacts of immigration, particularly for the working poor, black workers in particular, you know, she said, and this is a direct quote from her, that there's no national interest in continuing to import lesser skilled and unskilled workers to compete in the most vulnerable parts of our labor force. And that is, I think, still very much true today, all these years later, after she said that.
You're tuned to Midday here on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Aaron Henkin in for Tom Hall. I want to change topic slightly here, Jill and Hans, to talk about Trump's Secure Communities program, which is the part of his policy, as I understand it, that calls for cooperation between local law enforcement and federal ICE authorities. Some cities are saying this cooperation is causing friction between local authorities and the communities that they protect. And Trump's answer to that is that he is vowing to block federal funds from so-called sanctuary cities that adopt policies to shield undocumented immigrants. Let me turn to you first, Jill, and have you talk about Baltimore's status and about sort of what it's doing or not doing in terms of complying and cooperating with federal authorities.
Sure. I wanted to go back to one quick point that Mr. Hans raised about the impact of immigrants on our economy. I would say that study after study shows that by and large, immigrants are creating businesses and jobs in the United States. That's why a recent Yale study shows that immigrants actually take jobs that U.S. workers won't take and actually complement U.S. job force, creating job growth and higher level jobs for U.S. workers. That is why we saw almost 100 large business owners and leaders come out against the Trump enforcement, executive orders. There are businesses here in the United States, many, many businesses here who value immigrant workers, understand the value of what they bring to our job force. So just didn't want that narrative.
We hear the counterpoint, Jill, and we are coming up close to the end of the program. So I'll let you just recap and with an update on where Baltimore stands as officially a welcoming city now,
right,
if not a sanctuary city.
The mayor of Baltimore, Catherine Pugh, has essentially continued the policy of the former mayor that Baltimore City is a welcoming city. It limits its cooperation with federal immigration authorities, just as many jurisdictions here in Maryland do, as opposed to Harford and Frederick County, which actually have agreements with the federal government to help facilitate immigration enforcement. Baltimore City gave up control. There's one thing about sanctuary cities, if you want to look at why jurisdictions are called that, and that's Baltimore City gave up control of its detention facilities years ago. So the state controls that. So Baltimore City would never be able to call itself a sanctuary because that definition depends upon the city's ability to act upon federal detainer requests.
Attorney Jill Bussey is Advocacy Director for the Catholic Legal Immigration Network Incorporated, known as Clinic. Clinic, a nationwide network of nonprofit organizations that offer immigration legal services through organizations such as Catholic Charities. Joining us on the phone this hour has been Hans von Spakovsky, Senior Legal Fellow at the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Jill, Hans, thank you to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
We have got more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's going to wrap it up for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the show, it's the Midday Culture Connection with guest host Dr. Sherry Parks and a conversation about how differences in culture often lead to the tension and mistrust between police and African Americans. A word of thanks here now to The Diz for providing lunch today for midday guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. Features signature burgers, wings, steaks, jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. They're on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Aaron Henkin. It's been a pleasure to sit in for Tom Hall this hour, and I want to say thanks for listening and have a great day.